Her name is Rosanna.
And she done you wrong, I said. Why do you say that? Cause when you talk about her, your face says that you've been done wrong. He gave me a brief smile. Do you know how many black men live in Russia, Dresden? No, I mean, I figure they're kind of a minority. Sonya stopped in mid-strop and glanced at me for a pregnant moment, one eyebrow arched. Yes, he said, his tone dry. Kind of. More so than in the States, I guess. He grunted. For Moscow, I was very, very odd. If I went out to any smaller towns when I was growing up, I had to be careful about walking down busy streets. I could cause car accidents when drivers took their eyes off the road to stare at me. Literally. Many people in that part of the world had never seen a black person with their own eyes. That is changing, slowly. But growing up, I was a minority, the way Bigfoot is a minority. A freak. I started putting things together. That's the kind of thing that's bound to make a young man a little resentful. He went back to sharpening the sword. Oh, yes. So, when you say that Tessa prefers to take recruits she knows will be eager to accept a coin, I speak from experience, Sonya said, nodding. Rosanna was everything that angry, poor, desperate young man could dream of. Pretty, strong, sensual. And she truly did not care about the color of my skin. Sonya shook his head. I was 16. I winced. Yeah, good age for making really bad decisions. I speak from experience, too. She offered me the coin, Sonya said. I took it. And for 5 years, the creature known as Magog and I traveled the world with Rosanna, indulged in every vice a young man could possibly imagine, and obeyed Tessa's commands. He shook his head and glanced up at me. By the end of that time, Dresden, I wasn't much more than a beast who walked upright. Oh, I had thoughts and feelings, but they were all slaves to my baser desires. I did many things of which I am not... He broke off and turned his face away from me. I did many things. She was your handler, I said quietly. Rosanna. She was the one getting you to try the drugs, to do the deeds. One little step at a time. Corrupting you and letting the fallen take control. He nodded.
And the whole time, I never even suspected it. I thought that she cared about me as much as I cared about her.
He smiled faintly.
Mind you, I never claimed to be of any particular intelligence.
Who got you out? I asked him. Shiro?
In a way, Sonya said. Shiro had just driven Tessa from one of her projects in... Antwerp, I believe. She came storming into Rosanna's apartment in Venice, furious. She and Rosanna had an argument I never completely understood. But instead of leaving when I was told to do so, I stayed, to listen. I heard what Rosanna truly felt about me. Heard her report about me to Tessa. And I finally understood what an idiot I'd been. I dropped the coin into a canal and never looked back. I blinked at him. That must have been difficult.
My entire life has been one of a snowball in hell, Sonya said cheerfully, though the metaphor is perhaps inverted. At the time, I judged the action to be tantamount to suicide, since Tessa was certain to track me down and kill me. But Shiro had followed her to Venice, and he found me instead. Michael, not the Chicago Michael, the other one, met us at Malta and brought Esperakios here with him, offering me the chance to work against some of the evil I'd helped to create. From there, I have been knighting. It's good work, plenty of travel, interesting people, always a new challenge. I shook my head and laughed. That's putting a positive spin on it.
I am making a difference, Sonya said, with simple and rock-solid conviction. And you, Dresden? Have you considered taking up Fidolakios, joining us?
No. I said quietly.
Why not? Sonya asked, his tone reasonable. You know for what we fight. You know the good we do for others. Your cause runs a close parallel to ours, to protect those who cannot protect themselves, to pit yourself against the forces of violence and death when they arise.
I'm not really
into the whole God thing, I said.
And I am an agnostic, Sonya responded. I snorted. Hell's bells. Tell me you aren't still clinging to that. You carry a holy blade and hang out with angels.
The blade has power, true. The beings allied with that power are somewhat angelic, but I have met many strange and mighty things since I took up the sword. If one called them aliens instead of angels, it would only mean that I was working in concert with powerful beings. Not necessarily the literal forces of heaven or a literal creator, Sonya grinned. A philosophical fine point, true, but I am not prepared to abandon it. What we do is worthy, without ever bringing questions of faith, religion, or God into the discussion.
Can't argue with that, I admitted. So, tell me, Sonya said, why have you not considered taking up the sword? I thought about it for a second and said,
because it isn't for me.
And Shiro said I would know who to give it to. Sonya shrugged and nodded his head in acquiescence.
Reason enough, he sighed. We could use Fedelakius's power in this conflict. I wish Shiro were with us now.
Good man, I agreed quietly. He was a king, you know.
I thought he just liked the king's music.
No, no, I said. Shiro himself. He was a direct descendant of the last king of Okinawa, several generations back, but his family was royalty.
Sonya shrugged his broad shoulders. There have been many kings over the centuries, my friend, and many years for their bloodlines to spread through the populace. My own family can trace its roots back to Salahuddin.
I felt my eyebrows rise. Salahuddin? You mean Saladin, king of Syria and Egypt during the Crusades?
Sonya nodded. The same. He paused in mid-strop and looked up at me, his eyes widening.
I know you're agnostic, I said. But do you believe in coincidence?
Not nearly so much as I once did, Sonya replied.
That can't be a coincidence. Both of you descended from royalty. I chewed on my lip. Could that have something to do with who can take up one of the swords?
I am a soldier and an amateur philosopher, Sonya said. You are the wizard. Could such a thing be significant?
I waggled a hand in midair.
Yes and no.
I mean, there are a lot of factors that tie magic to matters of inheritance, genetic or otherwise. A lot of the old rites were intimately bound up with political rulers.
The king and his land are one, Sonya intoned solemnly.
Well, yeah, Sonya nodded. Michael showed me that movie. Merlin was the only good thing about that movie. That and Captain Picard kicking ass in plate mail with a big axe. I waved my hand. The point is that in many cultures, the king or sultan or whatever held a position of duty and authority that was as much spiritual as physical. Certain energies could have been connected to that, giving the old kings a form of metaphysical significance.
Perhaps something similar to the power of the swords? Sonya asked.
I shrugged. Maybe. By the time I was born, the planet was running a little low on monarchs. It isn't something I've looked at before. Sonya smiled.
Well, now you need only find a prince or princess willing to lay down his or her life over matters of principle. Do you know any?
Not so much, I said. But I got a feeling we're onto something. I glanced at the clock on the wall. It's getting later. I'll be back here in about 2 hours, or I'll call.
Da, Sonya said. We will watch over your criminals for you.
Thanks, I said, and went back out to the workshop. Hendrix had slumped to the floor and was sleeping. Guard was actually snoring. Thomas had been pacing restlessly when I entered.
Well?
He asked. Gotta get to Max and meet Murphy, I said. Let's roll. Thomas nodded and headed for the door. I reached into the trash can by the door, took out an empty motor oil can, and tossed it into the least cluttered corner of the workshop. It bounced off something in midair, and Molly let out a soft yelp, appearing there a moment later, rubbing a hand to her hip.
Where'd she come from? Thomas demanded crossly.
What did I miss? Molly demanded, her tone faintly offended.
I had all the senses covered. Even Thomas didn't know I was there.
You didn't miss anything, I said. I just know how you think, Grasshopper. If I can't make you stay where it's safe, I might as well keep you where I can see you. Maybe you'll even be useful. You're with us. Molly's eyes gleamed.
Excellent, she said, and hurried over to join me. Chapter 16. I was more than an hour late, and Murphy was not amused. Your nose looks worse than it did yesterday, she said when I sat down at the table. I think the black eyes have grown, too.
Gosh, you're cute when you're angry, I responded. Her eyes narrowed dangerously. It makes your little button nose all pink and your eyes get bloodshot and even bluer.
Did you have any last words, Dresden, or should I just choke you now?
Mac! I called, raising a hand. Too pale!
She fixed me with a steady look and said, Don't think you can buy your way out of this with good beer.
I don't, I said, rising. I'm buying my way out of this with a really, really good beer.
I walked over to the bar as Mac set two bottles of his microbrewed liquid Nirvana down and took off the caps with a deft twist of his hand, disdaining a bottle opener. I winked at him and picked up both bottles and sauntered back over to Murphy. I gave her her bottle, took mine, and we drank. She paused after the first taste and blinked at the bottle before drinking again more deeply.
This beer, she pronounced after that, just saved your life.
Mac's a master beeromancer, I replied. I'd never tell him, but at the time, I wished he'd serve his brew cold. I'd have loved to hold a frosty bottle against my aching head for a moment. You'd think the pain from the damn broken nose would fade eventually, but it just kept on stubbornly burning. We had settled down at a table along one wall of the pub. There are 13 tables in the room and 13 wooden pillars, each extensively carved with scenes mostly out of old-world fairy tales. The bar is crooked and has 13 stools, and 13 ceiling fans whir lazily overhead. The setup of the entire place is designed to diffuse and refract random magical energies, the kind that often gather around practitioners of magic when they're grumpy or out of sorts. It offers a measure of protection from accumulated negative energies, enough to make sure that annoying or depressing vibes, for lack of a more precise term, don't adversely affect the moods and attitudes of the pub's clientele. It doesn't keep out any of the supernatural riffraff. That's what the sign by the door is for. Mac had the place legally recognized as neutral ground among the members of the Unseelie Accords, and members of any of the accorded nations had a responsibility to avoid conflict in such a place, or at least to take it outside. Still, neutral ground is safe only until someone thinks they can get away with violating the accords. It's best to be cautious there. On the other hand, Murphy said more quietly, maybe you're too pathetic to beat to death right now.
My nose, you mean? Compared to the way my hand felt, it's nothing, I said.
Still, can't be much fun.
Well, no.
She watched me through her next sip and then said,
You're about to play the wizard card and tell me to butt out.
Not exactly, I said. She gave me her cop eyes, all professionally detached neutrality, and nodded once. So talk.
Remember the guys from the airport a few years back?
Yeah, killed the old Okinawan guy in the chapel. He died real bad. I smiled faintly. I think he'd probably argue the point, if he could. She shrugged and said, tone quietly flat, It was a mess. The guys behind it are back. They've abducted Marcone. Murphy frowned, her eyes distant for a moment, calculating. They're grabbing his business?
Or forcing him onto their team, I said. I'm not sure yet. We're working on it.
We? You remember Michael? I asked.
Charity's husband?
Yeah. I remember that at the airport we found a couple of men with no tongues and fake identification. They'd been killed with long blades. Swords, if you can believe that in this day and age. It was messy, Harry. She put her hands flat on the table and leaned toward me.
I don't like messy.
I'm all kinds of sorry about that, Murph, I said.
It's possible that a grain or two of sarcasm was showing in my reply. I'll be sure to ask them to put on the kid gloves. If I survive asking the question, I'll let you know what they say.
Murphy regarded me calmly.
They're back then, I nodded.
Only this time they brought more friends to the party.
She nodded.
Where are they?
No, Murph.
Where are they, Harry? Murph asked, her voice hard. If they're that dangerous, I'm not waiting for them to choose their ground. so that we have to rush into a hostile situation in response to them. We'll go after them right now, before they have a chance to hurt anyone else.
It'd be a slaughter, Murphy.
Maybe, she said, maybe not. You'd be surprised what kind of resources the department has gotten its hands on, what with the whole war on terror.
Right. And you're going to tell your bosses what?
That the same terrorists who attacked the airport and murdered a woman in the marina are in the city planning another operation. That the only way to ensure the safety of its citizens is to preemptively assault them. Then show up with SWAT, SI, every cop in town, anyone we can get from the Bureau, and all the military backup available on short notice.
I sat back in my chair at that, startled at Murphy's tone, and at the possibilities. Hell, the kind of firepower she was talking about might give even the Denarians pause. And given the current climate, terrorist plot was all but synonymous with respond with overwhelming force. Oh, sure. Most modern weaponry was far less effective on supernatural targets than anyone without knowledge of them would expect. But even reduced to the effectiveness of bee stings, enough bee stings, can be just as deadly as a knife in the heart. Humanity, at large, enjoys a dichotomous role in supernatural politics. On the one hand, they are sneered at and held in contempt for being patently unable to come to grips with reality, to the point where the supernatural world hardly needed to bother to hide from them. Given half a chance, the average human being would rationalize the most bizarre of encounters down to unusual but explainable events. They are referred to as herd animals by a lot of the things that prey on them, and often toyed with and tormented. On the other hand, no one wants to get them stirred up, either. Humanity, when frightened and angry, is a force even the supernatural world does not wish to reckon with. The torches and pitchforks are just as deadly in their numbers and their simple rage as they ever were. And it was my opinion that most of the supernatural crowd had very little appreciation for just how destructive and dangerous mankind had grown in the past century. Which is why I found myself sorely tempted to let the Denarians get a big old face full of angry cop. 5 or 6 rifles like guards might not kill Mantis Girl, but if you followed them up with 30 or 40 pairs of stompy combat boots for all the little bugs, little Miss Clamp Hands could go down for the count. Of course, all that was predicated on the idea that the humans involved A, knew what they were up against, and B, took it seriously and worked together tightly enough to get the job done. Murphy and the guys in SI might have a pretty good grasp of the situation, but the others wouldn't. They'd be expecting a soldier movie, but they'd be getting something out of a horror flick instead. I didn't for 1 second believe that Murphy or Stallings or anyone else in Chicago could make everyone involved listen to them, once they started talking about demons and monsters. I rubbed at my head again, thinking of Sonya. Maybe we could try to explain it in more palatable terms. Instead of shape-shifting demons, we could tell them that the terrorists were in possession, get it, of experimental genetically engineered biometric armored suits. Maybe that would give them the framework they needed to get the job done. And maybe it wouldn't. Maybe they'd run into something out of a nightmare and start screaming in fear. Coordination and control would go right out the window, especially if the Denarians had anyone with enough magical juice to start blowing out technology. Then would come the panic and slaughter and terror. It's an idea, I said to Murphy. Maybe even a workable idea, but I don't think its time has come. At least not yet. Her eyes flashed very blue. And you're the one who decides. I took another sip of beer and set the bottle down again deliberately. Apparently. Says who? Murphy demanded. I leaned back in my chair. In the first place, I said quietly, even if you brought in all that firepower, the best you could hope for is a hideously bloody, costly victory. In the second place, there's a chance I can resolve this whole thing through council channels, or at least make sure that when the fur starts flying, we're not in the middle of a bloody town. But you, and in the third place, I continued, I don't know where they are.
Murphy narrowed her eyes, and some of the tension abruptly left her features. You're telling me the truth.
Usually do, I said. I could probably track them down given a day or so, but it might not come to that. She studied my face for a moment. But you don't think that talk will stop them from whatever they're doing here? Not a chance in hell. But hopefully I'll talk them out of the woodwork to someplace a little more out of the way. What if someone gets hurt while you're scheming? She asked. Those encounters people were having last night are getting attention. No one's been hurt so far, but that could change. I'm not prepared to tolerate that. Those were something else, I said tiredly. Something I don't think will be a threat to the public. I told her about Summer's hitters. She drank the rest of the beer in a single tip, then sighed. Nothing's ever simple with you. I shrugged, modestly. Here's the problem, Harry, she said quietly. Last time these maniacs were around, there were bodies, and there were reports. Several witnesses gave a fairly good description of you.
And nothing came of it, I said.
Nothing came of it because I was in charge of the investigation, Murphy corrected me, her tone slightly sharpening. The case was never closed, and if similar events bring it up again, there's no way I can protect you. Stallings wouldn't. John would probably try, Murphy said. But Rudolph's been ladder-climbing over in Eternal Affairs, and if he gets an opening, he'll start screaming about it, and the case will get kicked up the line and out of SI's control. I frowned at that, turning my bottle around slowly in my fingers.
Well, I said, that could complicate things.
Murphy rolled her eyes.
You think?
Damn it, Harry. A long time ago, I agreed with you that there were some things that it was better the department didn't get involved in. I promised not to go blowing whistles and raising alarms every time things got spooky. She leaned forward slightly, her eyes intent. But I'm a cop, Harry. Before everything else, my job is to defend and protect the people of this city.
And what do you think I'm doing?
The best you know how, she said, without heat. I know your heart is in the right place, but you can be as sincere as hell and still be wrong. She paused to let that sink in. And if you're wrong, it could cost lives. Lives I'm sworn to protect. I said nothing. You asked me to respect your limits, and I have, she said quietly. I expect you to return the favor. If for one second I think that letting you handle this is going to cost innocent lives, I'm not going to stand quietly in the wings. I'm going in and bringing everything I can get my hands on with me. And if I do that, I expect your complete support.
And you're the one who gets to decide when that is, I demanded.
She faced me without flinching, not a millimeter. Apparently. I leaned back in my seat and sipped beer with my eyes closed. Murphy didn't know everything that was at stake here. More than anyone else on the force, sure, but she was operating under only partial knowledge. If she made the wrong call, she could really screw things up beyond all ability to conceive. She probably had the same exact thought about me, and on more than one occasion. I'd asked Murphy for a lot when I'd asked her to trust me. How could I not return the favor and still call myself her friend? Simple. I couldn't. Hell, if she decided to go in, she'd do it with or without me. In that circumstance, my presence could mean the difference between a bloody victory and a disaster, and I suddenly felt a lot more empathy for Michael's confusion. I opened my eyes again and said quietly, "You decide to bring CPD in. You'll have my cooperation, but you have got to believe me. This isn't the time for that kind of solution." She ran her thumb over a scar in the wooden table. What if that building had been full of people, Harry? Families. These Denarians could have killed hundreds. Give me time, I said. She put her hands on the table's edge and rose, facing me with those same neutral eyes again. As she started to speak, I got a twisty feeling in the pit of my stomach. I wish I could, she said. But... The door to the pub slammed open hard enough to strain its hinges and leave marks against the old wooden wall. A thing came through the door. It was hard for me to tell what it was at first. Imagine a big man trying to squeeze into a doghouse. He has to crouch down and go in sideways, one shoulder at a time, moving very carefully to avoid harming himself on the doorframe. That's what this huge, gray-furred thing looked like. but with horns and cloven hooves. The enormous Gruff, several feet taller than any ogre or troll I'd ever seen, squeezed all the way through the door and then rose to a crouch, his head, shoulders, and the top part of his back pressed against the ceiling. Hunched awkwardly, he slowly scanned the room, his golden eyes gleaming around their rectangular pupils. Each knuckle of his closed fists was the size of a freaking cantaloupe, and a heavy, pungent animal scent filled the air. Thanks to the snow, the pub wasn't crowded, just a few regulars, plus Murphy and me. But even so, this wasn't something you saw every day, and the room went totally still. The Gruff's gaze settled on me. Then he duck-walked toward my table. Mac raced for the switch that turned off the fans, but the first couple of spinning blades the Gruff passed struck sharply against his curling horns and shattered. He did not so much as blink. He stopped beside my table and surveyed Murphy, then turned his huge, heavy gaze to me.
"Wizard,"
he rumbled in a voice so deep that I could feel it better than I could hear it.
"I have come hence to speak to thee about mine younger brothers."
The Gruff's huge eyes narrowed, and its knuckles creaked like shipping hawsers as its fists tightened.
"And the harms thou hast wrought upon them."
Chapter 17. I picked up my staff and rose to face the enormous Gruff. Murphy watched me with very, very wide eyes.
"This is neutral ground," I said quietly.
"Aye,"
the Gruff agreed.
"The Accords alone keep thy neck unbroken, thy skull uncracked."
"Or your enormous ass uncooked," I replied, staring up and setting my jaw. "Don't start thinking it would be easy, Tiny."
"Mayhap, and mayhap not," the Gruff rumbled. "'Tis a question answered only by the field."
I breathed as shallowly as I could. The huge Gruff didn't smell bad, precisely, but he sure as hell smelled a lot.
"Speak." "We find ourselves at odds, friend of winter," the Gruff rumbled.
"Friend of summer, too," I said. "They gave me jewelry and everything."
"Aye," the huge Gruff said. "You have done good service to my court, if not to my queen. I am surprised, then, at your use of the bane upon two of my younger kin."
"The bane?" Murphy said quietly. "Iron," I clarified. I turned back to the Gruff. "They were trying to kill me. I wanted to survive."
"No friend of either court would so employ the bane, wizard," the Gruff growled. "Did you not know this? It is more than a mere weapon, and the pain it causes more than simple discomfort. It is a poison, body and spirit, that you have used upon us."
I glared at the big idiot. "They were trying to kill me," I repeated. Only more slowly, you know, so it would be all insulting. "I wanted to survive." The Gruff narrowed its eyes.
"Then you intend to continue as you have begun?"
"I intend to survive," I replied. "I didn't ask for this fight. I didn't begin it."
"Thou art fated to die in any case, mortal, soon or late. Why not face it with honor and make thy passing more peaceful thereby?"
"Peaceful?" I asked, barely containing a laugh. "If I go down fighting, Tiny, I plan for it to be about as unpeaceful as things get." I jabbed a finger at him. "I've got nothing against you and your brothers, Tiny, except that you keep trying to freaking kill me. Back off, and it won't have to get any uglier than it already has." The Gruff growled. It sounded like a dump truck grinding its gears.
"That I will not do. I will serve my queen."
"Then don't expect anything but more of the same from me," I replied.
"You would behave this way in the service of winter?" the Gruff demanded, incredulous. "You, who struck the heart of Arctis Tor? What hold has the Dark Queen upon you, mortal?"
"Sorry, Tiny, but you aren't nearly as special as you think you are. This is pretty much the way I behave every time someone tries to whack me." I gestured at him with my staff. "So if you came here to try to talk me into lying down and dying, you can leave the way you came in. And if you're the one coming after me next, you'd better have more brains than your brothers did, or I'm going to leave you as a great big pile of cold cuts and spare ribs." The Gruff growled again and gave me a stiff nod.
"Then come out,"
and let us settle this.
Showing bravado to the bad guys, or the not-so-bad guys, as the case may be, is a given, a part of the territory. But I'd never taken on anything with the sheer mass of Tiny the Gruff, and I really didn't think I'd care to try my hand against him without one hell of a lot of preparation first. I also had to remember that big didn't necessarily equal stupid, not given the circles he apparently moved in. In fact, most of the higher reaches of the summer court knew a formidable amount of counter-magic. If Tiny here had half the ability I'd seen demonstrated in the past, I would be in real trouble in a straight fight. All he had to do was stand outside and wait. Mac's place had only the one door. Worse, Thomas and Molly were waiting outside in Thomas's barge, and they would be sure to join in. I wasn't sure what could happen at that point. Leaving totally aside the fact that we'd be brawling in the middle of Chicago in broad daylight, I had to think that the Gruff might have backup waiting nearby to intervene if anyone outside the business of the courts of winter and summer tried to interfere. Molly was of limited capability in a fight, and Thomas tended to believe that the best way to approach any given combat was with a maximum of power, speed, and aggressive ferocity. Things could get really messy, really fast. I was trying to think of a way of getting out of this without getting anyone killed when Murphy put her gun on the table and said, in a very clear, loud, challenging tone, "I don't think so." The Gruff turned to stare at her in surprise. So did Mac. So did everyone else there. Heck, so did I. Murphy stood straight up and turned to face the enormous Gruff with her feet spread. "I will not let this challenge to my authority pass." The Gruff tilted its head to one side. Its horns dug furrows in the wooden ceiling. Mac winced.
"Lady," it rumbled.
"Do you know who I am?" Murphy asked.
"A lady knight, a shield-bearer of this mortal domain," the Gruff replied. "An officer of the law, or so I believe it is called."
"That's right," she said calmly.
"I make no challenge to your authority, Dame
Murphy," she said.
"Dame Murphy," rumbled the Gruff.
"But you do," Murphy said. "You have threatened one I am sworn to protect." The Gruff blinked, a considerable gesture on his scale, and glanced at me.
"This wizard?"
"Yes," Murphy said. "He's a citizen of Chicago, and I am sworn to protect and defend him against those who would harm him."
"Dame Murphy," the Gruff said stiffly, "this matter is not one of mortal concern."
"The hell it isn't," Murphy said. "This man lives in Chicago. He pays taxes to the city. He is beholden to its laws." She glanced aside at me, and her mouth quirked wryly. "If he is to suffer the headaches of citizenry, as he must, then it is fair and lawful that he should enjoy the protections offered to every citizen. He is therefore under my protection, and any quarrel you have with him, you also have with me." The Gruff stared at her for a moment, eyes narrowed in thought.
"Art thou quite certain of thy position, Dame Murphy?"
"Quite certain," she replied.
"Even knowing that the duty solemnly charged unto me and my kin might require us to kill thee?"
"Master Gruff," Murphy replied, laying a hand on her gun for the first time, "consider for a moment what a steel-jacketed round would feel like as it entered your flesh." The Gruff flicked its ears in surprise. A number of napkins were blown from the surface of a nearby table.
"Thou wouldst aim such weapons of the bane at a lawful champion of the Seelie Court?"
"In your case, Master Gruff," Murphy said, "I would hardly need to aim." Then she picked up the gun and aimed it at the Gruff's eyes. I started to panic. Then I saw where I thought Murphy was going with this one, and I had to work to keep myself from letting out a cheer. The Gruff's knuckles popped again.
"This," it growled, "is neutral ground."
"Chicago," she replied, "has never signed any accords. I will fulfill my duty."
"Attack me here," the Gruff said, "and I will crush you."
"Crush me here," Murphy said, "and you will have broken the accords while acting on behalf of your queen. Was that your intention in coming here?"
The Gruff ground its teeth, a sound like creaking millstones. "My quarrel is not with you.
If you attempt to take the life of a citizen of Chicago, whom I am sworn to protect, You have made it my quarrel, Master Gruff. Does your queen wish to declare a war upon the mortal authorities of Chicago? Would she wish you to decide such a thing? The Gruff stared at her, evidently pondering.
Lady has a point, Tiny, I drawled. There's nothing to be gained here but trouble, and nothing to be lost but a little time. Walk away. You'll find me again soon enough.
The Gruff stared at Murphy and then at me. If I'd been less intrepid and fearless, I would have held my breath, hoping I'd avoided a fight. As it was, I held my breath mostly to cut down on the smell. Finally, the Gruff bowed its head toward Murphy, with more scraping of ceilings and wincing of bartenders.
Courage, he rumbled, should be honored. Though thou art less a man than I thought, wizard, hiding behind a mortal, however valiant she may be.
I let out a long breath as silently as I could and said, Gosh, somehow I'll try to live with myself.
It will not o'erburden you long. This I promise.
The Gruff nodded once to Murphy, then turned and scuttled out the way he'd squeezed in. He even shut the door behind him. Murphy let out her breath and put her gun away in its shoulder holster. It took her 2 or 3 tries. I sank into my chair on weak legs.
You, I said to Murphy, are so hot right now.
She gave me a weak smile. Oh, now you notice. She glanced at the door. Is he really gone?
Yeah, I said. I figure he is.
The summer court aren't exactly sweetness and light, but they do have a concept of honor. And if any fairy gives his word, he's good for it.
Mac did something I'd rarely seen him do.
He got 3 black bottles out from beneath the bar and brought them over to the table. He twisted the tops off and put one down in front of me, and another in front of Murphy, then kept the 3rd for himself. I took up the bottle and sniffed at it. I wasn't familiar with the brew, but it had a rich, earthy aroma that made my mouth water. Without a word, Mac held up his bottle in a salute to Murphy. I joined him. Murphy shook her head tiredly and returned the salute. We drank together, and my tongue decided that any other brew it ever had would probably be a bitter disappointment from this day forward. Too many flavors to count blended together into something I couldn't describe if I had a week to talk about it. I'd never had anything like it. It was God's beer. Mac drained the bottle in a single pull with his eyes closed. When he lowered it, he looked at Murphy and said, Bravely done. Murphy's face was flushed with relief and with a reaction to her beer that was at least as favorable as mine. I doubt Mac could have seen it, but I'd known Murph long enough to see that she started blushing too. Mac went back to the bar, leaving Murphy and me to finish our bottled ambrosia.
Okay, Murphy said in a weak voice. Where were we? You were about to tell me how you thought I was wrong and that the Chicago PD needed to intervene.
Oh, Murph said. Right. She stared after the departed Gruff for a moment.
You said that thing was from the nicer of the 2 groups causing us grief?
Yep, I said. We've gone up against the supernatural 3 times, she said quietly. It's ended badly 2.
We, meaning the cops, of course.
I nodded. One of those occasions had killed her partner, Ron Carmichael. He hadn't been an angel or anything, but he had been a good man and a solid cop.
All right, she said quietly. I'm willing to hold off for now, on 1 condition.
Name it.
I'm in, from here on out. You obviously need someone to protect you from the big bad billy goats.
I snorted. Yeah, obviously. She held up the last of her beer. I held up mine. We clinked them, finished them, and went back out into the winter cold together.
Chapter 18.
All right, I said. I hereby call this war council to order.
We were all sitting around my tiny living room, eating Burger King. Thomas and Molly had voted for McDonald's, but since I was paying, I sternly informed them that this was not a democracy, and Burger King it was.
Hail to the king, baby.
Murphy rolled her eyes over the whole thing.
War council? Molly asked, wide-eyed.
Are we going to start another war?
I sort of meant it as a metaphor, I said, as I made sure the ketchup mustard ratio on my burger was within acceptable parameters. I need to decide on my next step, and I've been hitting the head a few times lately.
Figured my brain could use a little help. Just now worked that out, did you? Thomas murmured. Quiet, you, I growled. The idea is to generate useful thoughts here. Not funny ones? Molly said, suppressing a laugh. I eyed her. She ate a French fry. Murphy sipped at her Diet Coke. Well, she said, I don't know how much advice I can give you until I know what you're up against. I told you in the car, I said, the Knights of the Blackened Denarius. Fallen angels, old tarnished coins, psychotic killers. Got it, Murphy said. But that doesn't tell me what their capabilities are. She's got a point, Thomas said quietly. You haven't said much about these guys. I blew out a breath and took a big bite of hamburger to give me a moment to think while I chewed. There's a lot that these things can do, I said afterward. Mostly, the coins seem to allow their users to alter their physical form into something better suited for a fight than a regular human body. Battle shape-shifting, Molly said. Cool. It isn't cool, I told her. Then I paused and admitted. Okay, maybe a little. It makes them harder to hurt. It makes them faster. It arms them with various forms of weaponry. Claws, fangs, that kind of thing. Cassius looked like he might have had a poisonous bite, for example. Urseal's wielder could shift into this huge bear thing with claws and fangs and horns. Another one turned her hair into about a million strips of living titanium blade, and they were whipping all over the place and shooting through walls, stretched out like 20 or 30 feet. I have some customers like that, Thomas quipped. Murphy blinked and glanced at him. I cleared my throat and gave Thomas another glare. Another one of them, Nicodemus, didn't seem to do any shape-shifting, but his freaking shadow could leap off the wall and strangle you. Creepy as hell. They don't all have, like, a uniform or something? Molly asked. Not even close, I replied. Each of the fallen seems to have its own particular preferences, and I suspect that those preferences adapt themselves differently to different holders of the coins. Quintus Cassius's fallen had this whole serpent motif going, and Cassius's magic was pretty snake-intensive, too. But he was totally different from Urseal, who was totally different from Mantis Girl from this morning, who was different from the other Denarians I've seen. Murphy nodded. Anything else? Goons, I said. More like a cult, really. Nicodemus had a number of followers whose tongues had been removed. They were fanatics, heavily armed, and crazy enough to commit suicide rather than be captured by his enemies. She winced. The airport? Yeah. That it? No, I said. Nicodemus also had these, call them guard dogs, I guess, except that they weren't dogs. I don't know what they were, but they were ugly and ran fast and had big teeth. But all of that isn't what makes them dangerous. No, Thomas said. Then what is? The fallen, I replied. The room fell silent. They're beings older than time, who have spent 2,000 years learning the ins and outs of the mortal world and the mortal mind, I said quietly. They understand things we literally could not begin to grasp. They've seen every trick, learned every move, and they're riding shotgun for each coin holder, if they aren't in the driver's seat already. Every one of them has a perfect memory, a library of information at his immediate disposal, and a schemer that makes Cardinal Richelieu look like Mother Teresa hanging around in his brain as an advisor. Thomas stared at me very hard for a moment, frowning. I tried to ignore him. Murphy shook her head. Let's sum up. An unknown number of enemies with unknown capabilities, supported by a gang of madmen, packs of attack animals, and superhumanly intelligent pocket change. She gave me a look. It's sort of tough to plan for that, given how much we don't know. Well, then that's what we do next, isn't it? Molly asked tentatively. Find out more about them? Thomas flicked a glance at Molly and nodded once. To do that, we'd have to find them, I said. A tracking spell? Molly suggested. I don't have any samples to work with, I replied. And even if I did, somebody on their team was able to obscure Mab's divining spells. I'm nowhere close to Mab's league. My spells wouldn't have a prayer. If they've got that much of an entourage, they're going to stick out anywhere even vaguely public, Murphy mused. A gang of toughs with no tongues? If the Denarians are in town, that should make them relatively easy to locate. Last time they were holed up in Undertown, I said. Believe me, there's plenty of room for badness down there. What about the spirit world? Thomas asked quietly. Surely there's an entity or two who could tell us something.
Possibly, I said. I'm on speaking terms with one or two of the Loa. But that kind of information is either expensive or unreliable, sometimes both. And remember who we're talking about. The Fallen are heavyweights in the spirit world. No one wants to cross them.
Molly made a frustrated sound.
If we can't track them with magic and we can't find them physically, then how are we supposed to learn more about them?
Exactly, kid, I said. Hence the whole war council concept.
We ate in silence for a few minutes. Then Murphy said, We're coming at this from the wrong angle.
Huh? I said, wittily.
We're thinking like the good guys. We should be thinking like the bad guys, figuring out what they had to face and get around.
I leaned forward a little and nodded at her to go on.
I don't know as much about the supernatural aspects of this situation, she said. I don't know much of anything about these Denarians, but I do know some things about Marcone. For example, I know that even if he has some underlings who want to take over the franchise, he's got more who are personally loyal or who will figure that bailing him out will reap some major profits.
Yeah, I said, tilting my head at her. So?
So, wherever they took him, it has to be somewhere Marcone's network can't reach. We can be virtually certain that they aren't hiding in plain sight.
I grunted.
Hell's bells, yeah. Not only that, but Marcone plans ahead. He had that panic room ready to go. In fact, my eyes widened, the location of your secret hidey hole ought to be awfully secret, don't you think?
Sure, Molly said. What good is a hiding place if everyone knows where it is?
The Denarians knew exactly where he was going, I said. The spell they set up to tear down that building's defenses was no spur-of-the-moment magic. It was too complex. It had been planned out ahead of time.
Son of a bitch, Thomas swore. Someone inside Marcone's organization ratted him out.
So if we find the rat, Murphy said, catching on, we might find a trail that leads back to the Nickelheads, I finished with a fierce grin. Was this war council concept a brilliant idea or what?
Molly tittered.
Nickelheads. I have a gift, I said modestly. Then I added in a low voice, and stop giggling. Wizards don't giggle. Bad for the image.
Molly buried her giggle in another mouthful of fries. I slurped on my Coke and turned to Murphy.
So, what we need to do is figure out who's going to backstab Marcone. Someone highly placed enough to know the location of the safe house and who will profit by Marcone's absence.
You're assuming the informant was complicit, Murphy said. That wouldn't necessarily be true. Someone could have inadvertently given information away or been compelled to cooperate.
I paused to think about that.
True. So we'll have to start by looking at who could have given away the safe house.
Murphy raked her fingers through her dark golden hair, frowning in thought.
To be honest, SI doesn't cross trails with the outfit all that often. I'd have to make some calls to find out.
Thomas drummed his fingers on the arm of his chair.
The FBI would have more, wouldn't they?
And you know that guy Rick, right? Molly said. The one who was helping that jerk interrogate me?
Murphy's eyes narrowed. She made a noise that wasn't quite an agreement, but wasn't quite a denial, either.
Murphy has issues with her ex-husband.
It took Molly about half a second to figure out the expression on Murphy's face. She looked around the room somewhat desperately for a moment.
So Harry, what's with Mister? He's been sleeping like a log the whole time we've been here.
Which brings us to the second part of the problem, I said. The hitters from the summer court. I think odds are good that they've got my place under surveillance.
Thomas arched an eyebrow.
I didn't sense anything coming in.
You didn't sense anything walking through the front door of the pub either, Murphy said archly.
I was circling the block, Thomas said crossly. Middle of a damned blizzard and you still can't find a parking spot. I hate this town.
I've got warning spells spread out all around this place, I said. Anything gets within a block and I'll probably know about it.
And you've got to get up early in the morning to sneak past Mouse.
Mouse, who was sitting in front of Molly making soulful eyes at her chicken sandwich, glanced at me and wagged his tail.
If they were very close, I'd know it.
They're probably spread out in a loose ring, watching who comes and goes, I said. The gruffs don't really want to kick my apartment door down, not yet, at any rate. They'd rather fight where there won't be collateral damage. But I've got a feeling that they aren't at their best in all this snow.
Molly frowned. You think Mab is influencing the weather for you? Maybe the ongoing record snowfall is a coincidence, I said. But if so, it's awfully convenient.
Nothing's ever convenient with you, Dresden, Murphy said.
Exactly my point. I rubbed at my jaw. I needed to shave, but my throbbing nose was bad enough without adding a couple of razor nicks to the mess. I didn't trust my hands to be steady. There were too many scary things moving around. And if I stopped long enough to think about how far in over my head I was getting, I might just crawl into a hole and pull it in after me.
Don't think, Harry. You know too much about what you're up against. Analyze, decide, and act.
Okay. We can assume that the summer crew saw us come in. As long as we don't leave, they'll assume that we're still here.
Molly said, Aha! I wondered why you asked me along.
I winked at her.
Know thyself, grasshopper.
Yeah.
When we leave, I want you to make sure that the Gruffs and their crew don't notice.
Hopefully that will buy us some more time while they play patient hunter and wait for me to expose myself again.
Thomas sniggered. Expose yourself.
Murphy tossed an onion ring at him, which he caught and popped in his mouth. Meanwhile, I've got a new toy for you to play with, Thomas.
My brother arched his eyebrows and focused his attention on me. I went into my tiny bedroom and came back out with a small figurine, a rough figure of clay that resembled Gumby more than anything. I lifted it to my mouth and breathed on it, then murmured a word and said, Catch. I tossed it to Thomas. My brother caught it and, suddenly, a tall man, too lanky to look altogether healthy and with too many rough edges to be handsome, sat in Thomas's chair, dressed in his clothes. His hair had short waves in it and looked perpetually rumpled. His eyes were a bit sunken in a permanent state of too little sleep, but the line of his chin, strong and clean, made him look harder and sharper than he might otherwise have appeared.
Hell's bells. Did I really look like that? Maybe I needed a makeover or something.
Murphy sucked in a breath and looked back and forth between Thomas in his new look and me. Molly didn't bother trying to hide her reaction and just said,
Cool.
What? Thomas asked. Though the figure speaking looked like me, the sound of my brother's voice was unchanged, and a spot of ketchup from his burger still speckled one side of his mouth. He looked around for a moment, then scowled, rose, and ducked into my bedroom to look at himself in the little shaving mirror in the drawer in my bathroom.
You've invented a doll that turns people into their ugly half-brothers, eh? Get over yourself, pretty boy, I called. If you think I'm letting you break my nose to complete the look, you're insane.
I grunted.
Yeah, that's a problem. I had to set it up to look like I looked the day I finished it.
It isn't a problem, Molly said at once. I'll get my makeup kit and fix up his eyes for him, at least. I don't know what we can do for his nose, but from a distance he should look right.
If he looks like you, Harry, Murphy said, doesn't that mean he's going to be attracting some sort of hostile attention?
Thomas snorted and appeared in the doorway to my bedroom, his face ketchup-free.
Harry walks around looking like this all the time. Now that would be awful. I can handle it for a few hours. Don't get cute on me, I said.
Give us 2 or 3 hours lead time and then head out. Stay on the roads and keep moving. Don't give them a chance to surround you. You've got your cell phone?
I suppose, he said.
But given how much I've been hanging around you two in the bad weather, I'd say the odds were against it working. I grunted and tossed him my leather duster and my staff. He caught them and frowned.
You sure you don't want these?
Just don't lose them, I said. If the Gruffs saw a double of me who wasn't wearing the coat, they'd know something was up in a heartbeat. The idea is to keep them from getting suspicious in the first place. The charm should be good for another 6, maybe 7 hours. Once it drops, get back here.
Yeah, yeah, Thomas said, sliding into my duster.
The illusion magic didn't make the thing fit him, and he had to fiddle with the sleeves, but it looked like it always did on me.
Karen, don't let him do anything stupid.
Murphy nodded.
I'll try, but you know how he is. She picked up her coat and shrugged into it. Where are we going?
Back to guard, I said. The carpenter place. I'm betting Marcone left her a sample of his hair to use to track him down for just such an occasion as this.
But you said you couldn't get through the obscuring magic that the Nickelheads have.
Probably not. But if I know Marcone, he also collected samples of hair or blood from his people to find them if they ever needed help or...
Murphy grimaced. if they raided early retirement. I'm hoping Guard can give us an inside track on finding the leak, too, I said. Meanwhile, Molly hurried over to Thomas with her makeup kit and began modifying his face. Thomas's face was about level with the chin of the illusion me, if not a little lower, but I'd taught Molly the basics behind my illusion magic, such as it was. My skill with illusions was pretty basic, and it wouldn't stand up to any serious examination. Molly was able to scrunch up her eyes and see past it. Of course, you didn't have to make the illusion utterly convincing if you could manage to keep people from having a good reason to take a hard look at it in the first place. The illusion doesn't have to be fancy. It's the misdirection behind it that really matters. Molly had been caught in a goth undertow of the youth culture, and it showed in her makeup. She had plenty of blues and purples and reds to darken Thomas's eyes with, and the illusion of my face assumed an appearance fairly close to my own, sans the swollen nose. "It'll do," I said. "Murph, you're driving. Molly, if you don't mind." My apprentice grinned as she hurriedly pulled on her coat. Then she stuck her tongue between her teeth, frowned fiercely, and waved her hand at me with a murmur. I felt the kid's veil congeal about me like a thin layer of jello, a wobbly and slippery sensation. The world went a little blurry, as if I were suddenly looking at everything through hazy green water, but Murphy's face turned up into a grin. "That's very good," she said. "I can't see him at all." Molly's face was set with concentration as she maintained the spell, but she glanced at Murphy and nodded her head in acknowledgement. "Right," I said. "Come on, Mouse." My dog hopped to his feet and trotted over eagerly, waving his tail. Murphy looked in my general direction and arched an eyebrow. "If the gruffs don't buy it, I want all the early warning I can get," I told her. She lowered her voice and murmured, "And maybe you're a little nervous about going out without the coat and the staff?" "Maybe," I said. It was only a half lie. Insulting nickname or not, coat and staff or not, the more I thought about what we were up against, the more worried I became. I wasn't nervous. I was pretty much terrified. Chapter 19. It was dark by the time we got to Shea Carpenter, and we were beginning to slow down to turn into the driveway when Murphy said, "Someone's tailing us." "Keep driving," I snapped at once from where I was crouched down in the back of Murphy's Saturn. I felt like a groundhog trying to hide in a golf divot. "Go past the house." Murphy picked up speed again, accelerating very slowly and carefully on the snowbound streets. I poked my head up just enough to peer into the night behind us. Mouse sat up with me and looked solemnly and carefully out the back window when I did. "The car with one headlight pointing a little to the left?" I asked. "That's the one. Spotted him about 10 minutes ago. Can you see his plates?" I squinted. "Not through this snow, and with his lights in my eyes." Molly turned and knelt in the passenger seat, peering through the back window. "Who do you think it is?"
"Molly, sit down," Murphy snapped.
"We don't want them to know that we've seen..." The headlights of the car behind us grew brighter and began to sweep closer. "Murph, they saw her. Here they come."
"I'm sorry," Molly said. "I'm sorry."
"Get your seatbelts on," Murphy barked. Murphy began accelerating, but our pursuer closed the distance within a few seconds. The headlights grew brighter, and I could hear the roar of a big, old, throaty engine. I scrambled up to the back seat and clawed at the seatbelt, but Mouse was sitting on the other side of the buckle, and before I could get it out from under him, Murphy screamed,
"Hang on!"
Collisions are always louder than I expect, and this one was no exception. The pursuing car smashed into the rear of the Saturn at maybe 40 miles an hour. Metal screamed. Fiberglass shattered. I got slammed back against my seat and then whiplashed into the back of the driver's seat. Mouse bounced around, too. Molly screamed. Murph swore and wrenched at the steering wheel. It could have been worse. Murphy had gained enough speed to mitigate the impact, but the Saturn went into a spin on the snowy streets and revolved in a graceful, slow-motion ballet. Slamming my nose into the back of Murphy's seat didn't feel very good. In fact, it felt so not good that I lost track of what was going on for a few seconds. I was vaguely aware of the car spinning and then crunching broadside into an enormous mound of snow. The Saturn's engine coughed and died. My pounding heart sent thunder to my ears and agony to my nose. I barely heard the sound of a car door opening and closing somewhere nearby. I heard Murphy twist around in her chair and gasp, "Gun!"
She drew her weapon, unfastened her seatbelt, and tried her door. It was pressed into a solid wall of white. She snarled and crawled across the stunned Molly's lap, fumbling at the door.